regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
Government regulations, which were created to protect
the regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federal Society's fourth branch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. Today, we're pleased to bring you a great discussion on promoting a more adaptable physician pipeline, featuring James Capretta, who is a resident fellow and the Milton Friedman Chair at the American Enterprise Institute. Also, Chris Pope, who is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. If our audience would like to learn more about either of our speakers and their important work, you can visit regproject.org. That's regproject.org, where we have their full bios. In a moment, I'll turn it over to Jim to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion, we will go to audience Q&A, so please think of questions you'd like to ask our experts today. Thank you all for joining the call. Jim, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Nate. Really appreciate it, and I'm really pleased to be joined with Chris today. He's an excellent scholar from the Manhattan Institute, so it's nice to be able to do this with him. And I'll just go through a little bit what's in the paper, the sort of basic structure of it and the argument that I make, and focus mainly on the recommendations I have for how to change the current process. So to begin, it's important to understand that a little bit of history of how we got to where we are. As I dug into writing this paper, I became pretty fascinated by the history of how it evolved over time. Essentially, what it comes down to is that in the mid-19th century, there was a raging competition going on in the United States among different theories and approaches to medical practice. There was sort of the mainstream physician groups, and then there were two other competing approaches that really were based on less scientific approaches, you would say, and homeopathy being one. And these had a lot of adherence. They had a lot of professional adherence and a lot of patients who went to see physicians who practiced according to those protocols. And it was in 1847 that the AMA was founded. And at that time, they also built a bunch of state affiliates across the country. And pretty quickly, it became a very primary objective of that professional association to try to establish structure and processes and credentialing and licensing rules to limit who could be calling themselves a physician when they went out into communities to take care of patients. And so slowly but surely over the years, laws were passed by all the state governments to build a licensing process. I think the paper cites that about 400 laws were passed between the period of 1875 and 1915 at the state level. And so lots of things were done during that period. The big thing that then happened in 1910 was there was a famous study of the medical education system in the United States by Abraham Flexner. His findings were really important. Basically, he recommended the closure of the whole for-profit medical school structure that existed at that time, and tried to tie medical education to essentially the German model of medical education that was had well regarded and was really building on the scientific method and laboratory-based medicine as the way to train future physicians. Instead of being on intuition and hunch and, you know, old wives' tales, they started to really determine that medical practice really had to be tied to proof and scientific evidence of efficacy. And so that was a big part of it. And they also then built the whole system from those recommendations. They built the whole system of academic health centers being sort of the centerpiece of American healthcare, with medical schools attached to very prestigious facilities, all usually around a university setting. And so that was very consequential. And it set in motion even more activity at the state level. The number of medical schools dropped precipitously from 162 in 1906 to 69 in 1944. And all the for-profit system was sort of wiped away. And you moved toward sort of the modernization of the medical education system that in some sense is still prevalent in the United States today. So what did that lead? Well, basically it led to a system where the states controlled licensure. They all set up state licensing boards that were very closely tied to the profession itself through the professional associations. They also, through those professional associations, built a credentialing system for both medical schools and residency training. So to become a licensed physician now in the United States, you have to go through a credentialed medical school that has an oversight body that's very tied to the existing profession. And then you also have to go through a approved and accredited residency training program lasting at least 3 years, oftentimes many more, up to like 7. And for board certifications for various subspecialties, it could be even longer. So it's a very lengthy process for becoming a licensed physician. All of that is now controlled essentially through the state medical board system and affiliated organizations that do the credentialing of the schools and the residency programs. Now, one other element to this is important to understand is that, of course, we have a lot of foreign-born doctors in the United States. So the laws that govern that really, of course, are immigration laws at the national level. But it ties back into the state system in many ways as well. The federal government says here are the different categories of immigration law that would allow a foreign-born doctor to come to the United States, get trained, go to a residency program. But the institutions that are set up to also accredit the international medical schools, those are also tied back to the profession through a accrediting body. And these physicians really still have to be licensed through the state medical board system. So the federal government has a role really through either the restrictive or loosening restrictions or loosening of immigration law, but still the physicians who are foreign-born want to become U.S. practicing physicians, they still have to go through the state licensing board system. The final piece to understand as background is that there's a large component of federal funding involved, really directed at the residency training aspect of it. So the federal government, through Medicare, started way back in 1965 and then updated it in 1983, a payment system for both direct and indirect costs of residency training. There's a direct component where essentially the federal government will pay to teaching hospitals sort of a proportionate amount covering the resident salaries and also the salaries of the supervising physicians who run the residency training, as well as some associated overhead costs with doing that. So that's direct medical education paid for through Medicare. A second component is called indirect medical education, which is essentially an add-on to the payments that Medicare makes for services rendered to the Medicare patients in teaching hospitals. It's been shown numerous times that Medicare's payment for this, it's about a 5.5% add-on, is probably more than double the actual indirect cost of running a teaching program in terms of its indirect costs on patient care. Nonetheless, the Medicare program makes these payments. So the federal government has a big financial stake that adds up to, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 to $20 billion a year in residency training subsidies. There's a VA component as well as Medicaid, but the big one is Medicare. And the federal government really takes a hands-off approach, though. It just sort of sends the money and doesn't really try to get too involved in directing how the whole thing is run. So that brings me to sort of my recommendations. And the overall point of view of the paper is that this whole system obviously is very, very tied to the profession itself. And, you know, of course, my position at the American Enterprise Institute is I hold the Milton Friedman Chair, which, of course, is obviously a, you know, humbling thing to actually have to say to people sometimes. Yeah, I have the Milton Friedman Chair. It really has nothing to do with me. It's just a generous donor named this, one of the chair named at AEI for this great economist. But I bring up Milton Friedman because, of course, he wrote a famous treatise on the whole aspect of the medical profession, in a sense, being a cartel that controls supply, that allows their fees to be higher. And when you describe this whole process, as I've just done, in terms of how it actually runs, you can see that the whole system does get tied back very much to the profession, who heavily influence the state medical boards. In fact, you know, basically staff the state medical boards, and also heavily influence and control the credentialing system for both medical schools and the teaching hospitals that do the residency training. So the point of view of my paper is not to say that that is all bad. Of course, it isn't bad. You know, there needs to be, I would not be one who said, let's just get rid of it and, you know, trust that the market will sort out the quality standards that the public needs and wants. I think when you look at medical care, you need to say there needs to be very high professional standards, because a lot of times consumers are totally vulnerable and at the, you know, really are in the hands of a physician, especially if they're very sick and have to trust that the physician has their best interests at heart. So there is a public role, a very necessary and important public role, in setting very high standards for the physician community. I wouldn't want to reduce that at all. Having said all that, it wouldn't be I think, appropriate not to say that, you know, all other things being equal, if you've got more physicians practicing in a market as opposed to less, the fees that they charge for patient care will be lower rather than higher. In other words, the more the physicians have to compete against each other for the business of the patients that they serve, the more pressure there will be downward on the prices that they charge for what they do. So, you know, if we control the supply of physicians too tightly through the various mechanisms we set up to set up high quality, or, you know, high quality standards, then of course we're going to have higher physician fees and maybe even problems accessing care. So What I recommend generally here is something that allows this system to be much more flexible and adaptable and not so constrained, so that if a high-quality medical school wants to do a vast expansion and pump out a lot more physicians, maybe that would be something that could be done, especially primary care physicians, with a little bit less constraints as imposed in through today's system. Similarly, for specialists and others. And I also think that the signals of where patient demand is and where it's not being met needs to factor into that more readily and easily, so that the whole system becomes more adaptable over time and maybe moderate some of the cost pressures that are really driving up premiums and everything else for the consumers. So how do you do that? How would one go about making it more flexible and adaptable? I have basically five recommendations here. The first is that I would pool all the public funding that goes to residency training and try to make it one pool with a single, you know, direction in terms of the federal agency that does it, and have more directed, intentional objectives in terms of what you're trying to achieve with all this spending. And in particular, I think what needs to be done is some loosening of the institutions that get the money. Instead of this all being driven through a hospital-based residency training with big inpatient institutions tied to these very, very, you know, prestigious academic centers, but also extremely expensive inpatient institutions, I think what we need to do is start having some of the training and more of the money go outside of these big institutions to ambulatory settings and allow competition for the money on that basis. So open up the process to different types of residency training programs that aren't exclusively tied to teaching hospitals. So you got to pull the money out of Medicare's hospital payment system largely to start that process, pool it with the VA money, pool it with the Medicaid money, and start sending it to the competing institutions in ways that are different from the current Medicare money. And then the second point I would make there is that some of the money should go to the residents themselves. If we want to try to lower the barriers to entering the physician practice, one of the barriers is, of course, just the mammoth costs of medical education and then postponing high income based on residency training. This could offset some of that, not a lot, but some of that cost could be offset by providing vouchers or stipends directly to the residents rather than through the institutions that employ them. The second recommendation I have is to try to use the money that the federal government has under its control to steer the states toward, you know, loosening up how closely tied the oversight system is to the existing profession and people with an economic interest in the status quo. Definitely provide high professional standards. Physicians are going to have to be very involved in it, but you probably want to try to emphasize physicians that have some, you know, that are more disinterested and are not tied directly to some existing practices, some existing institutions, you know, and so that they have a real interest in trying to make sure that, you know, the patients get as readily and low-cost access to care as possible. And so anyway, loosen up the ties of the medical oversight system to the profession itself, and that would also translate into thinking about how to do the credentialing system that isn't tied directly to existing academic health centers and existing medical schools. Third recommendation is to try to move toward market-based pricing in Medicare's fee-for-service system. Physicians make the decisions about what kind of physician they want to be based a lot on the income they're going to earn once they become a physician. And the most important factor in that is Medicare's fee schedule. So there are lots of ideas to do this. I didn't have time in this paper to go through them all, but there are ways to make that system of paying fees more sensitive to price pressures in a competitive market, particularly through competitive bidding on the physician side. And that could send better signals to the physicians, because that all translates into commercial insurance too, about what kind of income they might earn, and you could get a better balance of physician practice, I think, if you had more market signals going into the fee schedule. The fourth recommendation is to look, and this is really something long-term project here, but is to think about and test maybe going to a six-year maybe even seven-year educational time frame for getting through the combination of a traditional college education plus medical school. Right now it's 8 years normally, 4 years in college, 4 years in medical school. Other countries, I note Germany really is a six-year program. Some of the kids coming out of high school, secondary school in Germany are a little older than the American kids, but still one could imagine a more condensed, combined college plus medical school education that, you know, tried to truncate things a little bit and get it down from 8 years to 6 years. For those young people that come into college knowing that they want to become a physician, maybe they start some of the classwork right away instead of, you know, waiting 4 years before they really get into their pre-clinical training education-wise. So it's just something to think about. The U.S. has toyed with and has tested seven-year time frames, particularly for primary care physicians. So I don't think it's a huge leap to think about whether or not our system could be condensed and allowed for quicker time frame from beginning to end of the school-based process for becoming a physician. And then the last recommendation is to become more liberalized on immigration law for foreign-born candidates who want to become licensed physicians in the United States. The main avenues to becoming, to getting a visa that allows a physician to do that are limited in terms of their numbers. They're somewhat constrained. So there's a lot more physicians probably very highly qualified physicians who'd like to come to the United States, practice here, but they're unable to do so because of caps on visas. We ought to think hard about creating a special category for physicians, both those who have done residency training and those who have not. And what do we want to do to allow people that are clearly highly qualified, ready to take care of patients in the U.S. and would like to move here to do so? They could be of great benefit to patients if the immigration laws were loosened in this way. And so I make that recommendation as well. So that's a lot to digest, I know, and I went too long. I'm sorry. But I'll stop here, and you know, Chris, I know, has some thoughts as well. So take it away, Chris.
Well, that's a great run through. Thank you, Jim. I'm sure that's very helpful to people. I think a lot of people start off thinking about a lot of healthcare issues in the United States from the perspective that we spend a lot more than other countries. Certainly, it's a common refrain that you hear from politicians. And it certainly is the case that for physicians, incomes and wages are much higher than they are abroad. So, for instance, in 2018, the average income of a general practitioner in the United States was $218,000 compared to $130,000 across the OECD as a whole. And the disparity was wider for specialists. Now, when you drill down into these numbers, it to a large extent reflects the fact that high income or educated workers earn much higher incomes in the United States than they do in other countries. And that's certainly a very important factor here. But it's also, to a large extent, a result of the fact that we train many fewer doctors than other countries. In the United States, we have 7.5 doctors per 100,000 citizens graduate, which is significantly less than in Germany, where it's 11.3, in Britain it's 12.8, in Holland it's 14.6. So we're probably like 30 to 40% down in terms of the amount of doctors that we're training per capita relative to other countries. So why is this the case, given that the wages would seem to be high enough to attract people into the profession? Are there barriers that are causing, that are deterring people from coming in? So I'm going to talk about four different types of barriers, four different stages in the process. Firstly, the undergraduate stage, secondly, the medical stage, the residency stage, and then the licensing stage. Now, the undergraduate stage is really to pick up a point on that Jim was right to mention earlier, which is that in most European countries, you can go straight to medical school as an undergraduate degree. You don't need to spend 4 years before beginning your medical classes learning social sciences or English literature or any other undergraduate college course. You can go straight out of high school to medical school, usually for a six-year degree. Whereas here, we do a four-year undergraduate and then 4 years of medical school. So that adds 2 years of extra tuition costs, 2 years of extra living costs, and 2 years of opportunity cost of lost earnings that individuals are losing. The other country that shares our orientation to sort of require undergraduate before going to medical school is actually Canada. And it turns out that Canada has a very similar amount of individuals that graduate. So theirs is 7.8 per 100,000 compared to 7.5 in the United States. So Canada also is way down. And you can also tell that this sort of impacts wage rates. Now, it's been said that I mentioned that doctors in the United States earn, like, a big reason why they earn so much more than other countries is the high educated workers earn more here. But if you compare to Canada, high-skilled Canadian workers outside of healthcare earn 26% less than their counterparts similarly educated in similar fields in the United States. And that's actually quite similar to healthcare. So in healthcare, Canadian healthcare workers earn 26% less than American healthcare workers doing similar jobs, similar levels of education. And in the workforce as a whole, Canadians earn 22% less than similarly educated American workers. So there is a sense in which this is sort of built in by the it sort of reflects the general nature of the labor force. Like, people choose to become doctors based on how the salaries compare to going to law school or to business school. The choice to go to medical school is sort of an equivalent choice. But then again, which sort of explains a sort of similar parity comparing to Canada. But then again, Canada itself imposes a hurdle that other countries do not. The actual regulatory barrier to it sort of imposes people to go to undergraduate prior to medical school is actually sort of not a hardwired and fixed thing. There is a national credential. The Liaison Committee on Medical Education accredits medical schools. It doesn't specifically require a four-year bachelor's program prior to admission, but it does require some of the arts courses. So even under existing regulations, there is scope to expand the sort of joint six-year programs for medical school, and that would certainly be very reasonable to consider. Now, thinking about medical schools is almost like the next hurdle. In 2019, only 21,000 out of 53,000 applicants were actually able to find places in medical school. So there is a big bottleneck even at that stage, not just the undergraduate stage. And then if you sort of think about going through the medical school process, like the average debt, median debt for a medical school graduate is now over $200,000. But in a strange way, this is sort of decoupled from the budget of medical schools, where medical schools actually spend most of their money on research. If you think of Harvard Medical School, the actual process of education only accounts for 6% of the budget. And so there is an asymmetry and a lack of close connection between the money that people are paying for the education and their ability to get an efficiently priced credential and training in return. That in some ways reflects the departure from for-profit medical schools. It reflects the sort of Flexner philosophy that it should really become part of an academic institution and part of this broader social mission. But it's really created a big hurdle. To give a sense of the nature of the hurdle, it can be kind of helpful to look at medical schools that many Americans actually go to, which are it's almost the workaround to the system, which is going to the Caribbean. So if you think about it actually is the case that 13% of graduates of medical schools that seeking medical residencies in the United States in 2019 were actually American citizens who trained abroad, who'd gone to medical schools in other countries and then come back for a residency. And when you sort of look at it, most often in the Caribbean, and when you look at the relative tuition, it's very obvious why they do. So in the United States, the average medical school tuition is $63,000 per year. In the Caribbean, it's $8,750. Now, obviously, there might be some quality differentials, but it really does give a good sense of the amount of fat in the system, the potential gain that could be achieved by shrinking the curriculum or making it much more focused on what needs to be done to sort of achieve residencies, to achieve a medical degree. And then of these 13% of medical residents, applicants to medical residencies, the majority of them actually ended up getting residencies in the United States for graduate medical education. So this isn't sort of all a matter of diploma mills churning out low quality degrees. These are basically people who meet the threshold and generally surpass it in many specialties. I think it's fair to sort of think of that as an indication of the potential that's out there rather than as a sideshow. Then going on to the next hurdle, which is the residencies, 20% of applicants failed to secure a placement in 2019. These are generally people who are qualified, who have gone through medical school, who passed all their exams, but there was just a scarcity of places. Now, the Jim mentioned correctly that Medicare has this role basically as a vehicle for subsidies for medical residency. But in practice, when this subsidy program was created in the 1997 Balanced Budget Act, there's basically no discernible impact on the amount of residencies that trained before or after. The trend line basically continued uninterrupted. I think it's fair to sort of question whether this is really nominally a graduate medical education subsidy program, or whether it's really just a fee adjustment for academic medical centers, which charge more to private insurers, and it's a way of rationalizing their ability to charge the Medicare program a little bit more. In practice, it has very little to do with the actual teaching of residents, and it comes with very few strings attached, and so it does very little to sort of increase the amount of medical training. What it actually does do in practice is it pulls residents into high-cost training settings. So of this Medicare GME money, the state of New York receives 50 times more per capita than Wyoming. And what this tends to do is it tends to pull residents into the big cities, very expensive cost of living, at an early stage of their career. And as a result, they tend to hang around later, makes it expensive for them to train, and then it keeps them away from parts of the country where we have workforce shortages. That, I think, is a poorly designed system. One could almost be honest about it and just simply decouple the GME money that's allocated through Medicare, move it away from the residency program, and be more honest about just getting residents trained in the settings that are more appropriate. The fact that residents are trained in academic medical centers, they're trained in emergency rooms, which are important right now, but in terms of the long run of a career, most doctors are going to be dealing with a chronic disease, primary care, long treatment of patients over time, building a relationship with patients. The emergency room is really not a great way to get experience in the kind of care that most doctors are going to be delivering for the vast majority of their career. And so it's very poorly suited in practice, as well as being greatly unnecessarily costly. And then if we think about the last hurdle on the training pathway, or the accreditation pathway, which is really licensing. So we have every single state has a different state medical licensing board, but only that means that if you want to practice in multiple states, you have to get a different license in every single state. Now, in practice, the licenses are actually very similar. It's not that much a matter of protectionism. The licenses basically have requirements that you have to go to an accredited medical school, have done an accredited residency. Well, those are both already nationally standardized, and have passed the U.S. medical licensing exam, which, as the name would suggest, is also nationally standardized. The differences between licenses are very small. The biggest difference is probably the fees, which can vary from $35 in Pennsylvania to $1,000 in Rhode Island. So in practice, there's very little reason for having a lack of mutual recognition of medical licenses across state borders. European Union countries already recognize medical licenses from different countries. So if you're trained in Spain and you want to go practice in France or Sweden or wherever, you can actually do that without any further accreditation. It would seem to be a very straightforward way to allow doctors to go where most needed, and also to practice telehealth across state borders. would be to allow require mutual recognition of state medical licenses. Given that they are so standardized, I think the United States would think of itself as more of a unified country than the European Union, and it makes sense that the medical workforce should be able to move along as flexibly as they are currently in Europe. So I think that those are really the four big stages to think of, like the undergraduate, the medical schools, the residencies, and then the licensing is real four different buckets of opportunity in terms of liberalizing the medical training pathway. There are a lot of opportunities up there. The politics of this, as Jim suggested, are not necessarily easy, but there's definitely a lot of options out there for improvement.
Very good, Chris. That was an excellent supplement to an addition and a lot of added information to what I was saying. So I think our points of view are very much kind of lined up. It's interesting that you note that the Canadian system also graduates a lower number of new physicians relative to its population, kind of in line with the United States and not as high as Europe. You know, even though Canada runs a nationalized system and their fees, you know, are controlled and so on, you know, the Flexner report, when it came out, started a process, and the Flexner report was actually a review of both the U.S. and Canadian medical school systems, and the system of recognition of physicians across the borders of Canada and the U.S. has been pretty seamless over the years. So they, in some ways, have the same medical training system, even though they have two very different, you know, obviously financing and payment systems for services. So I could see how Canada ends up in some ways with some of the same problems maybe that the U.S. has in terms of bottlenecks and hurdles that are impairing their ability to get larger numbers of people into the practice and thus lowering the cost for the consumer. In terms of the politics, you know, I mean, I'm wondering what you think in terms of something like allowing practice across state lines and, you know, sort of a almost like a national licensure system. I wouldn't recommend that necessarily myself, but specifically, what could the national government do to facilitate that?
So I think there are actually a whole host of interstate licensure compacts already between states.
Yeah, I did know that, yeah.
So those are quite inconsistent. Some of them have purely emergency provisions. Some of them are very limited. I think just as a standard matter, the fact that the Medicare program is willing to reimburse for anyone who's practicing in any state would suggest that from a Medicare program point of view, the federal government recognizes that every state's credential is adequate. And therefore, there's really very little reason to prevent that from a private point of view. Now, I think the big political hurdle with getting rid of state licensure is actually all about the fees. Because if you're a state licensing board, most of your revenue in most states, 100% of the revenue comes from the fees. And these boards do important ongoing activities. They are assessing the quality of doctors. They're assessing complaints. They're following up. They're often sanctioning and disciplining doctors that are falling short ethically and also in terms of competence. And that takes a certain amount of resources. And so there is a legitimate concern of states that if you were to force them to recognize licenses from other states, that, I don't know, New York no longer would have revenues all of a sudden to support its licensing board, and everyone would seek a license from the cheapest state, even though the actual content of the license doesn't matter. I think you could quite easily just say, okay, well, the federal government's we're going to federalize the financing of this. Certainly, given the amount of money that's being thrown around on Capitol Hill right now, just to eliminate that sort of regulatory hurdle, it seems like a tiny amount of money.
I think we missed our opportunity, right?
It's been estimated that about 30, $350 million per year state licensing boards get in revenue, which is a substantial amount of money to them, and it's a substantial amount of money to states. But from a federal point of view, I think allocating those funds, I mean, that would probably be the way to address that. I think ultimately it is probably largely about money, given that the regulations are actually fairly standardized already.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And what do you think of, you know, obviously there's an overarching theme here, which is that, you know, why is it, you know, similar to ask what's the political science reason why there seems to be extra hurdles here that don't exist in other countries. And perhaps one could say that, certainly I think Milton Friedman would have said that it's because we have a system that allows the physician community itself to maybe constrain the process, because if you're an existing practitioner, there's a strong financial incentive to say that, you know, we shouldn't allow other people to enter into this profession unless they're at least as high quality as me, and I don't want, you know, some people coming into the profession that are just going to do cut rate services and try to undercut my business, right? So there's a prevailing sense that that is part of the dynamic here. And it's a little bit hard to, certainly physicians, I think, probably resent a little bit people suggesting that that's part of the dynamic, but not trying to impugn people's character, but you're just trying to say, look, it's a natural organizational dynamic that would occur. The question is, what can be done about it? I don't know if you have any suggestions along those lines.
Yeah. I mean, in some sense, when you look at the state licensing, it's almost surprising how little protectionism there actually is. The fact that the licenses are actually pretty similar in practice. Where I think you see a little more protectionism, maybe. And this is on an issue that I don't think we touched on today, and that's the issue of board certification for specialists. And then there, I think there actually is much more barriers to entry than that are really quite deliberate in some ways, and certainly the highest paid specialists. You think of a neurologic surgeon who earns $800,000 a year per average. That the ratios are much higher for some specialties than others, and the residency review committees are often quite dominated by doctors on those specialists. You mentioned specialties. You mentioned also the Medicare fee system. Now it's a long-standing matter of controversy that it's been thought that these overpay for specialists relative to primary care through the way the Medicare pays. I think some of that's inadvertent, because the higher pay from specialists resulting from Medicare came out of the fact that they tend to be more procedure-based, and that they were more able to secure revenue add-ons that the Medicare payment system was sort of inadvertently doing. So I think that it's hard for rentsy, because as you were, to sort of openly defend practices. But if there are things that happen to be lucrative to my specialty or someone else's specialty or someone else's practice that have a public interest justification, those can be quite easy to hide behind. So I think getting sort of eliminating the public interest justifications or addressing them, taking care of the legitimate concerns that may be caused, that maybe enable sort of rent seeking to be sheltered, that's probably the best way to address this. Because I think the actual sort of naked rent seeking, the sort of physician groups like trying to inflate their incomes, not necessarily. That actually doesn't. I don't think that actually happens so much, because if you think of even like the years in which Congress was year in year out fixing SGR and adjusting physician fees, over those years, physician incomes were very very flat, certainly relative to other high-income professions, they were probably falling. And so it's not necessarily the case that doctors are as politically powerful as you might think. But like every special interest, they can be pretty good at defending existing roundabout practices that sort of have a public interest justification, but just happen to serve them in incidental ways.
Right. Well, Nate, maybe we should at this point open it up, see if anybody wants to ask us additional questions about all this.
Hi, this is Mike Doherty. I'm about a seven-year member of FedSoc, but I'm not a lawyer, and I'm the CEO of LabMD. So I have a very interesting perspective on this. I've worked in surgery since 85, and then I was in diagnostic medicine since 96. And quite frankly, what there's so many variables that I didn't hear you mention, having been deep into the bureaucracy of medicine, that I'd like to talk to you about what I don't think is really addressed. And I don't think you would know this unless you'd really been as deep in the beast. The number one reason I think physicians in the United States are very frustrated is because they have gone from a self-management system, by and large, to people that have not spent a day in an operating room or any medical capacity whatsoever putting bureaucracy in their path. And what they've been trained to do, they don't get to do. What they are doing is turning into bureaucratic processes to satisfy politicized people that are sort of babysitting them. And they're gutting sort of, you know, the practice of medicine to, and it's just not worth it. And they're gone because it's insane the amount of money. And you haven't mentioned the insurance companies. So, you know, with the flex test that you take when you pass your medical boards in the past few years, you know, going from state to state is nothing like it used to be. There used to be a day in South Carolina maybe 25 years ago, but that's how they kept everyone out that wasn't like a Southerner or from around there. And those are pretty much gone. But the actual day-to-day process of medicine, especially the more specialized you are, for surgeons or specialized people, has been gutted. So it's sort of a blended, you know, go along to get along, which doctor likes to be in a big organization on salary. That is not an environment for cutting-edge innovation or thought. It's an environment for longer patient wait times for mediocre medicine. And that is a type of thing that doesn't come out when you compare the United States to Canada. Because I remember I worked in lithotripsy in Seattle in the 80s developing stents and stone. And lithotripsy, we had three lithotripters in the United States at that point. And those are machines that, you know, pound kidney stones. And it was miraculous because you could have something not invasive versus having, you know, being in the hospital for over a week to have, you know, your ureter cut open. So we would get inundated in Seattle with Canadians that are wealthy. You know, just like what happens every place else. So I could probably go on and on and on, but there's a lot of variables involved in this that are way outside of medical school and licensing issues that we actually see during this coronavirus with the impact of our still allowing insurance carriers to run the show. And then when Medicare drags fees way to the floor, that's how Medicare practices medicine. When they see things they don't like, they don't disallow them. They just kill the payment for it, and then everyone loses money. And Obamacare has utterly annihilated rural hospitals. And so now everyone's on the news this week going, the rural hospital's going to go bankrupt in a week, and no one's asking why right now. But all these stages have been set so that physicians just show their arms up and go, I'm out. Because yeah. I can't fix this, and my life is a total hell because I'm running around being judged as a bad guy. So I could go on. I won't say a word about how the lobbyists do nothing but, you know, and the worthlessness of the AMA, but there are massive problems involved in this that I think are additional variables.
Well, I'll jump in here and just say I think I very much agree with the comments, and, you know, the paper that I wrote really wasn't intended to be an all-encompassing look at reasons for all the reasons for entry and exit out of the profession. And certainly frustrations post-license with how things have gone have led a lot of physicians to throw up their hands and move out of, you know, so their existing, you know, fee-based practices to go to a salaried system and all the things that were already just described. So I agree very much that those are big factors that are affecting the profession and numbers of physicians that are willing to practice, et cetera. I think those are all big factors. I was just in this paper just trying to look at the process by which someone who wants to become a physician, what do they got to go through to become one in the United States, and whether that can be addressed in a way that would allow it to be more flexible. It wouldn't necessarily address all these other things you're talking about, which is a big topic, and I've lots of views and points of view on how to fix American healthcare, but we're beyond the scope of this particular paper.
Jim, this is Nate. We've got three people waiting to ask a question. I wonder if we could try to move quickly through them all in the limited
time
left. All right,
that's a good reminder.
Let's try to.
I'll do my best to keep my answers short.
No. Sure. It was just a reminder. Next question.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you for a very interesting talk. I've been on the other side of medicine for 76 years, so I appreciate the perspective. The questions of medical licensing and getting into the practice side, it seems to me that the variation among states on licensing is a relatively minor problem from what I've heard, possibly with the exception of specialty and the need to have states license specialists. But that aside, I want to ask each of the speakers, and I do appreciate your insights, if each of you could wave a magic wand and do two things to improve the medical system in the United States, not just limited to becoming a doctor and going through the educational process that you talked about, just two things, I want each of you to tell me what you would do.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, my recommendation, I mean, I'll jump outside of the paper that I wrote and say I would do two big things. They're both big things. One would be a requirement. I wrote a paper about this. You can look it up on the AI website on how to do price transparency the right way so that we build a real and meaningful pricing system for the kinds of services that actually can be amenable to consumer price shopping. So a way of doing price transparency the right way. And then the second big recommendation would be to move all of our subsidy structures for putting people into insurance into more defined contribution amounts so that on the margins they have an incentive to go into lower cost, higher quality plans that are better managed and steer patients away from unnecessary and costly care.
Yeah, I think my two would probably also be outside of the workforce environment. I think the first one would probably be to let individuals buy their health insurance with pre-tax dollars so that it's not the case that employers are picking plans inefficiently for people and without any real sensitivity to price or value. So really to put individuals in control of insurance. And then the second one, I think, is you still need to fix the individual market. You still need to make the individual health insurance market an attractive one. And the way you do that is you let people get a discount if they sign up before they get sick, and keep that discount if they keep continuous coverage throughout the life cycle. That fixes the individual market, and then you make the individual market more attractive. That really starts to put the patient as consumer in control, and everything downstream from then at least is working in the right direction rather than trying to game a patchwork of poorly coordinated prices.
Great question and great responses. Let's move to our next caller.
My name is Karen Lugo, and I'm the attorney member of Federalist Society and the Family, but my husband is an ER physician. And he retired out of one of the nation's most respected medical delivery systems, had been chief of ER medicine, and yet the process of then becoming a per diem doctor and working across various states has been shocking. I know that it may appear that the standards are somewhat consistent, But by the time you get to the review boards, which you've mentioned, the scrutiny and the questions, when one who's had a career in medicine is going back 20, 30 years and retrieving documents, it becomes an onerous process. So wouldn't the idea at this point, when there are many physicians out there, maybe retired in a similar fashion, who would be willing to come back into medical practices, and by the way, my husband does, you know, there is the specialty consideration in his case, but wouldn't it be advantageous to look at something like that specs exam? I don't quite understand what's all involved there, but he described it as being fairly comprehensive. And then look at the recent performance background check of the physician and standardize that so that also the hospitals who participate would recognize the same standards, because I know that he has submitted a package for every additional hospital who also wants to go through the same approval process. So it has just been a very time-consuming. Some of the acceptance approval processes at the state level took more than a year and became very expensive. So I just, if there was a standardization of recognizing recent performance and whether a specs exam is also required, but to streamline this so that the hospitals and the states are all on the same page.
Well, I think that I'm not sure I have a huge amount to add to that. I'm certainly very sympathetic to it, and I think that's definitely something that the Congress can helpfully look at. I think there's a real sense in which the what we have is less than the sum of the parts. The fact that every single state is frustrating each other's doctors, is frustrating the patients. In aggregate, there aren't any winners really from such a fragmented system. It's not the system best designed to protect patients, and it's not the system best designed to get doctors to care for people where they're needed.
Yeah, I don't really have much to add. I agree with the recommendation of this really needs to be streamlined and made much easier for physicians that are in that kind of position. And so, yeah, I totally agree. We should, if Congress needs to step in and put a national solution on that kind of circumstance, maybe using Medicare's leverage to do it, I'd be for it.
Let's see if we can squeeze in the last question of the hour.
Yes, this is Chandler Bridges. I'm a lawyer in Atlanta, and my medical background is from my great-granddaddy in the 1880s to my brother, who practiced until 1990. Are you able to hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
So I have four statements and one question. What I'm hearing from everybody is centralized planning is the way to go. That medicine, you know, I'm hearing about socialized medicine. I'm hearing about socialized insurance. I'm hearing about socialized government funding through Medicare and things like that. And then when I look back, and I like the Bible, and Book of Samuel, they were clamoring for the Jewish Israel to be like the other nations. And that's where we come into comparing ourselves to Europe and Germany and Canada. And I don't think it's really that functional, but the fourth statement I want to make is that I'm really concerned about the conservative organizations such as we have speaking today embracing the socialization of society and the socialization of all economic activity, including medicine. So my question is there any academic study of non-socialized medicine delivery, non-socialized medicine? Because I remember when my granddaddy used to get chickens and eggs and cows for his services. And of course, you know, in the 60s, we all went to insurance, or the doctors did. So that's my question. Is there any study going on about trying to unsocialize medicine?
Well, I'll start on this. I work at the American Enterprise Institute, and I don't think anyone would say that the things that I've written about and the things that I work on and the positions that I've taken have been on the side of socializing the system, as you described. So I nor do my colleagues at AI really take that position. So I think what I would say to you is that what I try to advocate for is proposals and reforms that move the system that we have toward a market-based system with lots of private incentives in it, and in a way that it allows for much more flexibility and adaptation and innovation. So I think I generally agree with your point of view, and I think the things that I've written over the years go in that direction. Just as one example, you might want to look up at AI.org, a paper that I wrote recently, as I mentioned earlier, on price transparency. It's all driven by the same kind of point of view, I think, that you're that you take.
Yeah, I would say I want to certainly insist on the distinction between insurance and entitlements. And the insurance is, I mean, that's consumer product. Individuals are purchasing insurance, and we're in a very different world, I think, in healthcare from 60 or 70 years ago. We're no longer in a cash-based world. If we think about the major procedures that individuals are having these days, major hospitalization, or even a course of treatment outside the hospital, like a long course of drug treatment with multiple specialty visits, we're talking quite often tens of thousands of dollars, really not that rarely hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're not talking amounts of money that individuals are able to pay cash. And this is why insurance is dominating healthcare in a way that it didn't dominate healthcare 70, 80 years ago, and will continue to dominate healthcare. So I think the discussion really has to be how to get insurance more responsive to consumer preferences, how to get insurance functioning better as a market product, more competitive market. But we're not going back to the days when insurance was not the dominant payer in healthcare. That's just an inevitability, just because of the large amounts of money that treatments cost these days. And you know, that's ultimately not such a bad thing, because like these are treatments that we're glad exist. We're glad that people can have their hips replaced. We're glad that we have a growing array of cancer cures, and that we can do more for people that have a heart attack, and rather than sort of doing the low cost cash thing of just kind of maintaining them. It's ultimately trying to find a solution to these problems, but it's we're definitely not going back to the cash oriented healthcare world, for better or for worse.
Okay, gentlemen, we are running up on time. I'm curious if you have any final thoughts that you'd like to leave with our audience.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation, and I'm really glad it was done with Chris. He brought a lot to it and had a lot of information. So thank you to the Regulatory Transparency Project for, you know, allowing us to do it. You know, I think that my view is that the system we've had is done very well in terms of the United States has a very, very high quality physician workforce. We shouldn't lose sight of that. And most Americans, I think, find it to be so when they interact with their personal physicians. On the other hand, we probably could use a few more of them. And I think what we need to do is just think carefully about the existing system that was built really over the last 100 years, what we can do to modernize it, make it better for the coming century.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of broadly sympathetic with that view. I think in health policy and politics, it's so easy to fall into talking about enemies, like the hospitals are bad, the insurers are bad, the drug companies are bad, the doctors are charging exorbitant amounts, and sort of have a discussion of that sort. But what we're really talking about here is how do you make it easier for people to become doctors? How do you make it easier for our workforce to be expanded? How do you make it easier for people to get access to care? And those are the things that we're ultimately talking about today. Not only, hopefully, do they reduce the cost of physician care, these are things that physicians themselves will welcome. They will welcome that doctors would want fewer burdens into entering the profession. Certainly, the workforce of tomorrow would be enthusiastic about that, and certainly the workforce of a couple of decades from now.
Well, very good. Well, again, we want to thank Chris and Jim for an excellent discussion today, and invite our audience to check out Jim's new white paper at the Regulatory Transparency Project website. Gentlemen, thank you for your time and expertise. We welcome listener feedback by email, as always, at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you all for joining us. Have a great day.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.